You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 4th of February 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
The International Olympic Committee has the honour to announce the host city of the Olympic Winter Games 2022. Beijing!
Since that announcement was made in July 2015, the world has changed completely. We'll look at the effect of both politics and the pandemic on this major sporting event, which kicks off today. Then we'll join our team in Kiev, who've been speaking to the EU ambassador to Ukraine, and we'll hear about the latest travails of the Peruvian president, who's been forced to reshuffle his cabinet for the third time in 6 months. With a skip through the papers and a hit of business news, we'll need some light relief.
We learned that Giuliani appears curiously determined that, by golly, attempting to mount a coup d'etat from outside a gardening centre between a crematorium and a dildo shop will not be the least dignified abyss he plumbs.
That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. US President Joe Biden announced that Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurashi, the leader of the Islamic State militant group, died during an American raid. Four senior aides to Boris Johnson have resigned from their Downing Street posts amid growing pressure on the UK Prime Minister. We'll be covering this later on in the show. And the South African company Afrigen Biologics has used the sequence of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine to make its own version of the jab. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, the Winter Olympics open in Beijing today, and in the meteorological and political chilly climate, one guest is guaranteed a particularly warm welcome, Russian President Vladimir Putin. But in 2008, the last time Beijing hosted an Olympics, Russia invaded Georgia. Will the Kremlin rain on China's parade? Well, taking the temperature of the historic meeting, the first time Xi Jinping has hosted foreign leaders in almost 2 years, are The Telegraph's Sophia Yan on the line from Beijing. And here with me in the studio is Stephen Diel, a leading Russia expert and former senior Russian affairs analyst at the BBC World Service. Welcome to both of you. Stephen, do you think that Russia will repeat the events of 2008 and take the opportunity of the distraction caused by the Olympics to invade another former Soviet state?
It's not beyond the bounds of possibility. I mean, I'm not going to say, oh, yes, they're definitely going to do it. But the record of Russia acting, Russia indeed the Soviet Union, acting when the world is distracted is quite long. Go back to 1979, Christmas time, Russia invaded Afghanistan. You've already mentioned the start of the Beijing Olympics in 2008, Russia attacks Georgia. When they had their own Winter Olympics, the Russian Winter Olympics in Sochi, Putin, a year later only, boasted that on the day of the closing ceremony, he signed the order in the Kremlin to seize Crimea, and then got on a plane and flew down to Sochi to host the closing ceremony. So they've got a bit of a track record. So I wouldn't rule it out. I put it this way. I will be mightily relieved if we get to the end of these Olympics and there is no significant change on the Ukrainian border.
Mm. Sophia, let's come to you in Beijing. What's China's official line on Ukraine?
Well, China has tried to make clear that it will respect what Russia will do, might choose to do. One point that China and Russia do share is that they don't like the West in meddling in what they consider to be their own issues and domestic issues. And so China trying to stick to its own line, saying that the West shouldn't meddle within Chinese affairs, is taking a similar stance toward Russia. Now, there was some talk over the last few weeks that perhaps Xi Jinping had told Vladimir Putin to wait until after the Olympics, to not rain on Beijing's parade, essentially. It's unclear whether or not that is what she expressed to Putin. Beijing very much denied that strongly, which then makes you think that perhaps he did ask for that. But it is true that today, in just a few hours' time, the opening ceremony is going to kick off. And what China wants is really the world's eyes on its country, on this country of 1.4 billion. It does not want anything else to be distracting global attention. China wants everyone to know that it's hosting the games in the midst of a pandemic and that it's going to pull it off to the best of its ability.
Mm. So, Stephen, I mean, as we know, Putin is there today, as Sophia says. How vital is Beijing's support for him?
Pretty important. I see the relationship between these two actually as it's wonderful for radio. If I were a cartoonist, if Xi is the big figure, Putin is about up to his knee. Putin is very much the junior partner in this relationship. Putin and Russia versus China in total. Russia needs China far more than China needs Russia. Even if Putin did act against Ukraine while the Olympics were on, China would be annoyed, but also it would be a rather foolish thing for Putin to do because he can't afford to offend China. China has played up this relationship, and Xi has described Putin as his best friend. Well, dictators don't have many friends, if any at all, so that's not too surprising. And Putin really needs to play up this idea that he's gone to China. He is the biggest guest because there's been diplomatic boycotts by so many Western countries of these Olympics because of the Uyghur question in China. So Putin wants to make the most of that. So certainly I would not expect him to do what he did in Georgia in 2008 and on day one of the Olympics. That's when the fighting started in Georgia. So there's probably a few days grace at least. But it's very much that relationship. He needs Xi. He needs China much more than the other way around.
Yeah. So, Sophia, I mean, as well as attending the opening ceremony, there are going to be bilateral talks between the two leaders. What do you think's on the agenda aside from the security issue?
Well, these talks are very important in the sense that they are the first foreign political guests to be received in Beijing for almost 2 years, as authorities in China have tried to keep the capital city free of COVID. It's very telling that Putin is the first, and his foreign minister, Lavrov, that they're the first ones that Beijing, that Xi is willing to receive here, especially at such a momentous point, you know, right before the Olympics kick off. And so, you know, on the docket, they're going to be talking about in which ways they can coordinate to bolster ties between Moscow and Beijing. This is also the first time that they're meeting since pre-pandemic, since 2019. And this idea of coordinating in the face of Western pressure, this makes sense. The more that the West is trying to counter what Russia and China are doing, and in that sense, it only pushes those two nations together. And they have very fraught but influential ties. It's in a way a relationship of strategic convenience rather than true alliance, the way the West might choose to cement links with other nations. China and Russia increasingly finding common cause with what they see as blatant U.S. disregard for their concerns. And they've had a similar approach toward the U.S., almost a gleeful take on the kinds of challenges that Washington has faced politically the last couple of years, more recently with the U.S. Capitol riot, challenges in curbing COVID. Of course, China and Russia also taking attempts to interfere and influence elections and public opinion, really mocking the U.S. And so they are starting to share a lot more in common. And so that is something, trying to find that more common ground is something that is likely to be on the agenda.
And Stephen, how damaging for the West could any deals between the two powers be? I mean, for instance, the idea that there might be a gas pipeline between the two.
Not damaging at all, actually, because the gas is from different gas fields. This has got nothing to do with Nord Stream 2. If the West refuses to accept Nord Stream 2, that doesn't mean that Russia can just send the gas the other way. This is one of Russia's handicaps, in a sense, is it's such a big country. The gas they send to China comes from different gas fields. And just to show how pragmatic China is in this relationship, in 2014, after the seizure of Crimea and the invasion of Ukraine, Putin went to Beijing, and the Chinese kept them talking and negotiating on energy and on gas until 2 o'clock in the morning, and they then the Russians trumpeted. They said, "Look, it's wonderful. We've got this fantastic deal with China." What actually happened? What came out as the analysts looked at it in the weeks after that was that it was actually costing Russia money to sell their gas to China. The Chinese had kept them at it for so long that they knew that Putin couldn't go back to Moscow without a deal. And so they kept them half up half the night and got a deal where it's costing the Russians money. The other thing, of course, is economically, China has much better relations with the rest of the world than Russia does. Mm. You go into any shop here in London or in any of the other capitals we're being heard and look for Chinese products. It won't take you very long to find something that says made in China. But then you try and find something that says made in Russia. Ooh, there's vodka. But apart from that, yes, oil and gas are the big exports. But otherwise, in terms of consumer goods, China has the market tied up.
Sophia, just before we go, how is Putin's visit being spun in China?
As one of a welcome friendship that Sino-Russia ties go way back, that they go back for decades, and that as neighbors, that this is a point of showing that they can indeed cooperate, you know, really trying to bring a counter to the kind of moves that the U.S. has made under President Biden to find more allies to deal with the rise of China, the Russia issue. And so this idea that China indeed has friends on the world stage, especially as Stephen mentioned earlier, in the face of all these diplomatic boycotts, being able to show that there is support for what Beijing is doing. And certainly the two countries are finding many more ways to partner in space cooperation, sharing military technology. There have been joint drills. So there's definitely more to come.
Sophia and Stephen, thank you both very much. That was The Telegraph's Sophia Yan in Beijing and the leading Russia expert, Stephen Diel. It's just gone 7:11 here in London and 9:11 in Kiev, which is where we're headed next. Back in 2013, it was Ukraine's desire to join the European Union that proved the spark for a wave of protests that would eventually depose a Russian-friendly government and set Ukraine firmly on a new path. It's that steady shift towards Europe and the West which has arguably set the stage for the current tensions with Russia. But where does the EU's relationship with Ukraine go from here? Monocle's Paige Reynolds has been speaking with Martti Masikas, who's a career diplomat from Estonia, who's been the European Union's ambassador to Kiev since 2019. He began by explaining how the EU has been aiding Ukraine over the past 8 years.
Since Maidan, since the Revolution of Dignity 2014, the EU has mobilized 17 billion euro to support Ukraine. And by far the largest assistance package ever allocated to a partner country. And it goes to investments, for sure. It goes to underpin and help big Ukrainian reforms, like for the public administration reform, more than 100 million euro has been allocated over the last couple of years. For the decentralization reform, something that a post-Soviet country with a very strict power vertical badly needed, to give more powers to the municipalities, to strengthen municipalities. The support has been over the last couple of years by EU and some member states has been more than 150 million euros. So there you have the dimensions of this assistance. But of course, it's also not about not only about money. The association agreement that the EU and Ukraine have in place, it's actually one part of it is the trade part where it's very much about standards and harmonization. Because if you want to trade with the EU, you need to, with the biggest trading bloc in the world and the very wealthy one, you need to follow the standards. But there are large policy areas where there are strictly speaking no EU standards, like the justice system. There is no EU standard of how many layers of courts you need to have, how should there be a separate constitutional court or not, etc. But it is crucially important for the rule of law and also for economy. I'm very proud that with the EU, the US and other G7 countries' strong support, sometimes a push. Last year, for the first time of the 30-year independence of Ukraine, a sweeping justice reform, cleaning up of the court system, was started, and we are supporting its implementation by top-level international experts, but also technical assistance and advice. We have, of those 17 billion, almost 1 billion has been allocated to deal with the impact of the conflict in the areas close to the line of contact, but also assisting, helping the internally displaced people elsewhere in Ukraine, building infrastructure, renovating infrastructure in conflict in areas close to the line of contact, etc., etc.
And I guess maybe a good final question is that, you know, Ukraine has definitely placed itself in the European camp. It's, you know, westward looking in that sense. Do you think that the sort of Ukraine's aim to be part of the EU, is that always going to be a dream, or is that going to be a reality? Hard to speculate, but right now, what do you think?
First of all, it's not only a dream. It's enshrined as a goal in Ukraine's constitution. The highest agreement state can do with its citizens. Secondly, and Ukraine is working hard, Ukrainian authorities are working hard every day, as does the EU, to bring Ukraine closer to the EU in all the senses of the word. Secondly, or thirdly, if a nation has chosen to become European in the political way, Ukraine is a European country by geography, history, economy, increasingly economically, but also in the political sense of the word. Who are we to say that, no, you can't do that? The association agreement is an invitation for EU-related reforms, an invitation to conduct the reforms Ukraine badly needs according to a European blueprint. This is how we help every day Ukraine moving closer to the EU.
And sort of maybe a bit more practically, you talk about these sort of reforming steps that Ukraine needs to take. Where are they kind of along the sort of that path? Are they halfway through, three quarters, or is it kind of, again, is it hard to say?
It's very hard to measure. It's not the natural science. There are again, two large parts of this. One is standards and harmonization, and that is clearly where Ukrainian business has taken the lead, because they do daily business. They conduct daily business with their EU partners. And there are, of course, always areas like, say, transport, where more can be done. Like, we have major railway law that needs to be adopted that would then enable much easier movement on railway. The gas market was set up according to the EU's rules. It's a very, very huge thing. Now Ukraine wants to synchronize its electricity grids with the EU grids, to desynchronize from the Russian-Belarusian grid and to synchronize with the EU grid. For that, you need much more than just the physical connections. You need to set up an electricity market according to the European model and standard. That will be one of the next big, I don't say battles, although always there are interests and there are elements related in these kind of issues. But it's the next big area of work, and the Ukrainian government and Prime Minister Shmyhal personally is taking that very seriously. So there you see, not only political, but also very, very practical and big areas that are being harmonized and linked with the EU.
That was the EU ambassador, Matti Maasikas, speaking with Monocle's Paige Reynolds. And you can hear the first part of our interview on yesterday's edition of the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24. Now, still to come on the programme, we'll have a Winter Olympics preview, plus Andrew Muller will share his assessment of what we know now that we didn't 7 days ago. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Earlier this week, Peruvian President Pedro Castillo reshuffled his cabinet for the third time during his first 6 months in office. This comes amidst a raft of senior resignations as he faces criticism over his handling of issues such as the fight against corruption and an environmental disaster from an oil spill on Peru's Pacific coast. Well, I'm joined now by Natalia Sobrevia Perea, who's Professor of Latin American History at the University of Kent. And Natalia is originally from Peru. Welcome to the show. Natalia, Castillo, the first peasant to become president of Peru, came to power in July. Now, he made some lofty promises to the electorate then. What were they and has he delivered?
He promised to change the country, to end with corruption, to make it a more equitable place, and he hasn't done anything that he promised.
This latest political turmoil has been unfolding for a while. Can you tell us how it began?
Well, it began because he had appointed some very respectable people to cabinet, and they were mainly the interior minister, Avelino Guillén, was trying to dismantle a corruption bracket within the police. And Castillo did not support him in fighting against this corruption racket. So he tendered his resignation, and the Prime Minister Mirta Vázquez, also very respected and environmentalist from northern Peru, she also tendered her resignation, and this ended the collaboration with the moderate left within his government. So all the ministers that had been very prepared and had been really trying to make some change in the country all left the government, and it's been very much moved to more corrupt forces.
So why does he not have support, though, in Congress?
He has never had support in Congress. There are people who have never accepted him as president, who have always just asked for him to either not be made president or to be ousted. So there have already been attempts to oust him, and there is a very strong opposition against his government. And he's tried to move closer to those that oppose him.
And who's replaced the ministers that resigned?
Are mainly from Congress or from political groups that have for a very long time been against Castillo. So the Prime Minister Valer, he comes from the extreme right, the religious right, groups that have denounced Castillo before. And this is a man who's known for having been part of several political organizations and to have his lobbyist interests at heart.
And as we've been discussing, corruption's a major issue. Can the new finance minister address that and also steady the currency, which is tumbling?
No, not at all. This is also there are many accusations about violence against women against several of the ministers. The number of women and men have completely lost balance. And Castillo's very much a man in search of some semblance of control, and he doesn't really have it. He gave some interviews last week to the international press, the national press, where he was saying that he's learning on the job, that he doesn't really know exactly how to manage. And clearly what he decided is that he needed new blood, and that the connections to more corrupt forces, less left-wing and more to the center or right, was the way to go. But he has really had a very mixed response, or very negative response, to the changes in the cabinet.
Now, he has 4.5 years left in office. Do you think he'll stay the course?
Well, people have been talking about him being ousted from the minute he was put into the presidency. So it's anybody's guess how long he will last.
Mm. And finally, Natalia, what's the latest on the environmental disaster caused by the oil spill?
Well, the new environmental minister is less prepared even than the previous one, who wasn't very prepared. The company Repsol, which is a Spanish gas company, is not really taking responsibility. The cleanup project is not going very well. And it's anybody's guess how deep this disaster will go. There's a long history of oil companies not taking responsibility for what they do. They usually do this in faraway places in the Amazon, so most people in Lima don't care. But now it's just outside the capital, it's into everybody's view, and there are many angry people.
Natalia, thank you very much indeed. That was Natalia Sobrevia Perea of the University of Kent. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. US President Joe Biden's announced that Abu Ibrahim al-Hashemi al-Qurashi, the leader of the Islamic State militant group, died during an American raid. 13 civilians, including children, reportedly also died during the incursion, which took place in Syria's Idlib province. Four senior aides to Boris Johnson have resigned from their Downing Street posts amid growing pressure on the UK Prime Minister. The top aides include Director of Communications Jack Doyle, Chief of Staff Dan Rosenfield, and senior civil servant Martin Reynolds. And the South African company Afrigen Biologics has used the sequence of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine to make its own version of the jab. The shot, which could be tested on humans before the end of the year, would be the first to be based on a widely used vaccine without the assistance of the developer. It's also the first mRNA vaccine to be produced at lab scale on the African continent. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Well, let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is the journalist and communications consultant, Simon Brook. And crucially, Simon did communications for the Conservative Party. Simon, I don't think there's a single paper in the UK today that doesn't have the word chaos in it to describe the current state of affairs in Downing Street. So give us some detail. It was probably the Prime Minister's worst day ever yesterday.
So far, yes. He hopes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. UK papers, widespread reporting of the resignations last night, as you say, at Downing Street. Dan Rosenfeld, Boris Johnson's chief of staff, has gone. Martin Reynolds, his principal private secretary, is also leaving, both by mutual consent. Jack Doyle, his director of communications, has also resigned, quoted in the paper, in the Times, for instance, that recent weeks have been have taken a terrible toll on my family life. Probably more significant, though, is the departure of Munira Mirza, who is Johnson's head of policy. She's known him for and worked closely with him for 12 years, most significantly probably before Downing Street, when he was mayor of London. And she's quite damning in her resignation letter. She the thing that's caused her to go is the very controversial claim made by Boris Johnson. You'll remember earlier in the week when he accused the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, of being a bit slack on the job when it came to investigating the shocking abuse scandals of Jimmy Savile, the entertainer or whatever. And according to Munira Mirza, she says that Boris Johnson is letting himself down by making scurrilous accusations. And so I think, as given that she is seen as somebody who is sensible, who has a direct line to him, who can restrain him, who can give him good advice, and the fact she's been with him so long, I think that's a really, you know, serious resignation. And the question now, of course, is who else will be going. It's worth noting, for instance, that her husband, Dougie Smith, also is a senior aide at Number 10. So I imagine he's, among others, considering his position.
I mean, as the Times report, cabinet ministers believe there's a 50-50 chance that Johnson will be forced out of office.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly these things move. As you say, that the Times have spoken to two cabinet ministers. One says, it feels like the end. It's all falling apart, 50-50. as you say. Another says it's difficult to tell. But I think what's interesting is the momentum has increased. There was a feeling in Westminster that let's wait and see what happens with the local government elections in May. And that will give us an indication of whether Johnson can hang on. But politics is all about momentum. And it certainly seems to be going in the wrong direction for Boris Johnson at the moment.
And the FT, of course, is talking about how the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, has criticised Johnson.
Quite extraordinary, really, because obviously one of the sort of cornerstones of of government in the UK is this cabinet collective responsibility. Whatever your colleagues say, whether you agree with it or not, as a fellow cabinet minister, you're supposed to back them up. So for Rishi Sunak to say that he wouldn't have made this comment about Keir Starmer is really quite remarkable. He did it in an interview with the BBC's political editor, Laura Koonsberg, yesterday. So there's a feeling now that he has, having been very cautious, inevitably, understandably, about his own leadership ambitions, there does seem to be a feeling that he's really setting out his stall. You know, he was asked about the alcohol and drinking at Number 10, claimed that he hadn't looked out of his window at Number 11 and seen it. And of course, the other thing about Rishi Sunak, it's worth remembering, is he is teetotal. And so I imagine his aides will regard that as, you know, as a way of really differentiating himself from the drinking culture at Number 10, which has been so controversial. Mm.
We should expect the story to move on significantly today, I would imagine. Let's go to the New York Times now and this raid targeting the ISIS leader.
Yeah, absolutely. So we haven't obviously heard a lot, certainly in the Western media, from the Middle East. But yes, the New York Times, among a range of newspapers, reporting a risky pre-dawn raid led by US Special Operations Forces that resulted in the death of the Islamic State's leader, Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi. He was hiding out, according to the New York Times briefing from the White House, at the top floor of a house in northwest Syria. And President Biden gave the decision to send about two dozen helicopter-borne commandos to kill or capture him. This is seen as a significant defeat for ISIS. Interesting analysis by the paper that it points out that for Mr. Biden, the success of the operation was a welcome relief from the looming threat of obviously the Russian possible invasion of Ukraine, and also important because following the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan last year, there's a widespread concern that the US evacuation of the country would give ISIS the opportunity to sort of retake territory and reassert itself. So this does seem to be a very strong, clear example of the US fighting back.
Mm. Let's go to Le Monde now, which is just one of a number of papers who cover this story about fake videos.
Yes. Yeah, so obviously, as we know, Moscow, the Putin regime, is very active when it comes to fake news. And the latest story is, as you say, reported in Le Monde, amongst other newspapers, that Washington has accused Moscow of releasing these false videos purportedly showing a Ukrainian attack on Russian forces, complete with bombed out buildings, with actors claiming it's said to be Russian relatives of Russians who have been murdered or whatever. The Le Monde, as I say, amongst other papers, quotes the Pentagon spokesman John Kirby saying that the video shows this attack, that it's very graphic, and that he believes that these videos do have the backing of the Kremlin. So the paper Le Monde also reports some diplomatic activity by President Macron, reminding us that the French president has met the Russian president three times and obviously had a meeting with Vladimir Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, as well. So from the sort of French perspective, it's interesting here how you're getting this kind of parallel diplomacy, you know, with NATO and the US on the one hand, but also President Macron, who, of course, described NATO a few years ago as being brain dead, is doing his own thing. Is that because there are presidential elections later this year, or is it just Macron's idea of this sort of EU approach to diplomacy alongside NATO? It's probably a bit of both, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. Finally, let's talk food or sort of food substitutes, really.
What the cluck, says the Telegraph about vegan brands. Silly sound. sounding fake meat. It says you can't moo for mock au vin and posh dog. Sorry. Andrew Muller really ought to be listening to this bit, shouldn't he? I have to say. Yeah, as I say, mock au vin and kicking collie katsu curry as well. So also mock a doodle tofu chicken pie. I also actually discovered there's phleg, which is sounds disgusting, but it's flax meal and egg. Sleight of ham.
Oh, my Lord.
Sham chowder. Take your pick or whatever. But I don't know. Is this the idea that the sort of the demographic, if you like, the target audience for vegans have a really silly sense of humour? I'm not sure. But certainly there must be people working in marketing departments racking their brains for the next great pun.
But I mean, the other point to make about these is that quite often these vegan these meat substitutes are not healthy.
No, well, that's the other question. Absolutely. Do they have fat? Do they have sugar? All these kind of things. And also questions about, big debate going on about the sustainability element. Jackfruit is available everywhere, but of course it has to come across from the other side of the world. Questions about soybeans and stuff like that. So I don't know. Yeah, it is a debate. I wonder whether it's the vegan marketing industry trying to keep it light and fun or whatever and sort of concerned about the fact that there might be growing fears about the environmental impact of their products.
Do you eat meat, Simon?
I do. I feel increasingly guilty about it. I don't know why. There is a film about the life of a cow at the moment, which is, I don't know if you've seen it, but apparently it's quite unsentimental, but it does make you question that. So, yeah, somewhat guiltily I do. What about you?
Well, yeah, no, personally my feeling is going vegetarian is a huge mistake. Oh.
Set you up for that, didn't
Simon
I?
Thank you very much indeed. It is 7:36 here in London and 8:36 in Zurich, and it's Friday, which means it's time for Andrew Muller's strange assessment of what we've learned over the past 7 days.
We learned this week and at last to begin to understand the conduct of UK Prime Minister, as of this recording, Boris Johnson.
Ooh, I can't wait to see where this goes.
Okay. Tell me more.
Let's see where this goes.
We learned that Johnson's premiership actually does make a kind of sense when viewed as the acting out of suppressed yearning to return to his previous easier life as a newspaper columnist taking wry, sidelong looks at the news. This would explain Johnson's apparent eagerness to keep lobbing gentle medium-pace long hops, a cricket metaphor, look it up later, in the direction of satirists, sketch writers, and indeed the compilers of whimsical news monologues, who haven't had it so easy since this guy.
And then they have cans of soup. Soup.
Remember that? Write it down or something. That was foreshadowing, a technique by which a theme is subtly established with a view to paying it off later in a piece of writing. It is, if you will, the Chekhov's gun of this week's What We Learned, cleaving to the principle that no element of a story should be redundant. That...
Oh, man.
Just... get on with it.
Anyway, we learned that Boris Johnson was going to make life easy for us twice over, once with the latest revelation of Downing Street's lockdown parties, which concerns an ABBA-themed wingding in the Prime Minister's own apartment, which has given us the excuse to play this. Homage to a leader undone by hubris, although Napoleon had previously had somewhat more luck than Johnson ever has getting Europe to do what he wanted. And the other with a flying visit to Kiev, there to meet sitcom star turned president Volodymyr Zelensky, which proved not far enough for Johnson to escape his domestic travails.
The crisis in number 10 caused you to delay or even cancel your talks with Vladimir Putin yesterday. Will you help draw a line underneath the saga by committing to publish the full Grey Inquiry, including any of the 300 plus pictures she might submit?
But did lay on any number of easy bait and switch swipes about a professional buffoon who owes his notoriety principle to clowning around in various media and generally making a spectacle of himself, inexplicably elevated to high public office and burdened at a moment of grave international crisis with life and death decisions to which he is no more suited than any given Marx brother. meeting President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine. We also learned of the plans Boris Johnson's government claims to have for the country as it released a white paper outlining its so-called Levelling Up programme. The Levellers. If we were any more on a roll, we'd be ham and cheese. We learned from the preamble of this white paper a surprising amount about the history of urban development from the dawn of time to the present day, and or the copy-pasting skills of its authors. Here is an actual excerpt, as read by Monocle 24's desperate padding out of word counts desk chief, Carlotta Ribello.
The earliest known permanent settlement to be classified as urban was Jericho around 10,000 years ago. The city had natural irrigation from the Jordan River, allowing it to produce and export the most extensive essential oil in the ancient world. This enabled Jericho to become a hub not only for commerce and trade, but for people and skills, culture and finance.
We learned at least that this government does not fear tempting fate. What with one thing and another, when one plays word association with the words Jericho and levelling, the next word is not usually up. One for the Old Testament heads there. And we learned of, and indeed struggled to suppress vindictive mirth at, the weird and abject twilight into which the populist titans of recently elapsed eras have tottered. We learned, for example, that Brexit advocate and Arthur Daily Tribute act Nigel Farage, following his recent personalised video message misadventures on Cameo, much exploited by puerile pranksters, is now pimping himself out at 74 quid a go on Thrills, with a Z, just in time for Valentine's Day.
Gift for Valentine's. Stuck for an idea. You can book me, Nigel Farage, here exclusively at Thrills, and send that special message to your boyfriend, girlfriend, partner, or whatever you call them.
So we learned that if you'd pay 74 quid to avoid having to deliver the "it's not you, it's me" speech, problem pretty much solved. And we learned that there is, unbelievably, someone even worse off, specifically Rudolph Giuliani, acceleratingly swivel-eyed commander of former US President Benito Cartman's elite strike force legal team. And this is the aft-shadowing of the foreshadowing we signposted earlier with this.
And then they have cans of soup. Soup.
You see now how it all hangs together.
Oh, you clever man.
You're so clever. Oh,
clever Clark.
Smart. Very smart.
We learned that Giuliani appears curiously determined that, by golly, attempting to mount a coup d'etat from outside a gardening centre between a crematorium and a dildo shop will not be the least dignified abyss he plumbs. For we learned that Giuliani has featured as a contestant in a yet-to-be-broadcast episode of imbecilic game show The Masked Singer. Echoing precisely that sentiment, we learned that two of the Dismal Talent Quest's judges, comedian Ken Jeong and Blurred Lines hitmaker Robin Thicke, were, depending on your level of cynicism, so outraged that they stormed off set, or such good team players that they were willing to participate in an obvious publicity stunt. Either way, we learned that Robin Thicke does have some standards, which was, grand scheme of things, vaguely heartwarming. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Many thanks there to Andrew Muller. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
And it's time now to talk business with Helen Morrissey, who's Senior Pensions and Retirement Analyst at Hargreaves Lansdown. Helen, thanks very much for joining us. Can we start with Facebook? It has had this catastrophic loss. I mean, I think the personal fortune of Zuckerberg lost more than the entire worth of Estonia. Tell us more.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it's a very strange stat, that, isn't it? We basically saw Facebook's owner, Meta Platforms, seeing its stock market value slump by, I think it was more than $230 billion yesterday. So that's a record daily loss, I think, for a US firm. Now, basically, the reasons behind this are slowing revenue growth. They're facing a lot of competition from rival platforms such as TikTok, for instance. And we're also seeing advertisers cutting spending. And basically, these factors saw its shares fall, I think it was 26.4% yesterday. As you say, we've seen Zuckerberg's net worth fall by around $31 billion. Now, there's a few factors there, as you say, slowing revenue growth, there's a lot of competition, but also Apple recently brought in some app tracking transparency policy. Now, this lets people choose whether or not they want to be tracked around the internet. And basically, this is an issue because companies like Meta do this and then they use it to sell that information onto advertisers. So this is causing them a bit of a sticky situation right now.
And is it impacting on the rest of the tech scene?
To be honest, I'm not too sure. I mean, I think, you know, anything like that, you know, if you are relying on being able to track people's, you know, journey around the internet and then to be able to sell that data on, then anything that comes in that allows people to choose whether they want that to happen or not is going to be a big issue for any tech firm looking to.
And looking at another US firm, Amazon is hiking its Prime membership, but its profits are surging anyway.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because, you know, as you say, they have seen a leap in the sales and profits because they had a really good busy Black Friday and Christmas period. But, you know, beyond this, they are basically saying that they're going to raise the cost of their Prime membership for customers in its US market. They've not said anything about the UK market as yet. We're expecting their sales figures today. But basically, they're going to be increasing their annual fee for the 200 million US members that they've got. It's going to go up for the first time in 4 years from $119 to $139. So that's a rise of, you know, 17%. But, you know, as you say, they had a very good Black Friday and Christmas period. You know, a lot of people rely on Amazon for their deliveries. You know, obviously their streaming service is very popular as well. So it's an interesting time to decide to hike those prices.
I mean, they're justifying this by saying that costs are rising, and I guess that's to do with supply chains and so on.
Yeah, and obviously that is a pretty universal issue affecting firms, isn't it? The, you know, we have had these supply issues and, you know, kind of labour shortages as well. And this is probably, you know, impacting, you know, on their costs going forward.
Mm. Well, of course, another cost that's rising worldwide, but we're reporting it a lot in Britain at the moment, is energy prices.
Absolutely. So yesterday, the big news was that the energy cap rise was announced yesterday, and it's looking to increase, you know, the average person's bills by almost £700 from April. So the energy price cap, it sets the maximum figure that can be charged to customers who are on like a variable dual fuel rate. And it's their typical usage of gas and electricity. And this is done every 6 months. Now, we have seen prices surge in recent months in the energy markets, and this higher cap means a typical household is going to pay £1,971 a year from April, and that's a 54% increase. So, you know, that is these are scary figures that are going to be worrying a lot of people. So the government was under a lot of pressure to do something to help people, and, you know, they announced yesterday a plan that would take the sting out of these rises. So as I said, we're looking at almost £700 rise. What they've announced is going to kind of take £350 off that. And what it basically is there's a council tax rebate, first of all, for people with homes in bands A and D of £150. Now, the other £200 is going to be taken off energy bills, not until October, but it will be taken off. But actually, it's a loan, and people are going to have to pay that back in instalments from next year. So the government has come under a lot of pressure from opposition parties saying, you know, why are you doing this? Why is it a loan? Why does it need to be repaid back? You know, what about very low income, you know, families and homes, you know, how is that going to affect them? I think one thing that Labour was saying is that the government should levy some kind of windfall tax on the likes of Shell, which we saw record very, very big profits, you know, earlier on in the week.
Yeah, and the one thing, of course, that we've been told we can't do, according to the governor of the Bank of England, is ask for a pay rise.
Yeah, this is a very interesting, nugget from the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey. It seems very strange, you know, as you say, yesterday they announced an interest rate rise that is going to add to the cost of mortgages and borrowing. You know, as you say, the squeeze on the cost of living, you would expect that people would be wanting to ask for a pay rise. But his feeling is that, you know, the bank has to get on top of inflation. So we're expecting it to go above 7% this year. It's more than three times the bank's inflation target.
Helen Morrissey, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. Now, we began today's programme talking about the Winter Olympics, and we'll end it there too, looking at the reality of holding such an event during a global pandemic. Joining me now from the south coast of New South Wales, Australia, is Monocle's sporting correspondent, Kieran Pender. Kieran, hello to you. Thanks very much for coming on the show. This is expected to be the most controlled international sporting event in history. What travel regulations are in place?
It's going to be a really remarkable Winter Olympics. I was in Tokyo covering the Summer Games 6 months ago for Monocle 24, and that was considered at the time to be a very tightly controlled environment, but this will be something else entirely. There's 60,000 people estimated to be in a fully closed loop bubble across three different sites. So that's athletes, journalists, officials, coaches, and support staff. They're in gated communities. They cannot leave that closed loop bubble. For people who are going into the bubble, you know, people in China who are assisting with the games, they've had to spend 3 weeks in quarantine before they're allowed into it. You know, to give a comparison to Tokyo, we had to do 14 days on arrival within an Olympic bubble, but we were still allowed to sort of go out and about within that bubble. You know, we were just staying in regular hotels. We were allowed briefly into supermarkets, etc. Whereas this is an entirely closed system. They've got robots cleaning everywhere. They've got daily PCR tests. This really takes COVID measures at a major international event to a whole new level, and comes as China more broadly tries to maintain a zero COVID approach. So while the rest of the world, you know, grapples with extremely high case numbers, numbers in China remain extremely low. And so the sacrifice of holding these games for China is the need to minimise numbers as much as possible.
You mentioned robots, and I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about the role of technology in running these games smoothly.
Yeah, there have been a few tweets from people on the ground and a few articles about how much technology is involved in this closed loop system. They've got robot cleaners, they've even got food servers in restaurants, even robot machines that are making meals in place of chefs. So that certainly generated some amusement. As always happens at the beginning of Olympics, there's always the issues and errors that pop up. One I saw today was someone tweeting sort of positive signage about the Olympics, trying to inspire people, but they'd forgot to insert proper text, and they just had the standard lorem ipsum Latin holding text, and yet it had been printed out and put up to inspire people. You always get that with games at the beginning, and normally it sort of irons itself out. But I guess the high stakes of these games with the COVID dimension and the extremely politicised nature of these games means that there's really little room for error.
And I wonder how that politicisation of the games works out on the ground. How will those diplomatic boycotts and the small number of very high-level visitors impact the event?
Yeah, well, I guess it remains to see how the next 2 weeks are going to play out, and the opening ceremony gets underway in just a few hours' time. Vladimir Putin will be there, and given the ongoing situation on the Russia-Ukraine border, he's being watched carefully. There's been some suggestion that any military measures on that border might be delayed while the Winter Olympics are ongoing, because Putin doesn't want to put off his Chinese counterparts. Just today, India has announced they're diplomatically boycotting the opening ceremony because one of the torchbearers is a Chinese soldier who was injured in border clashes with India a few months ago. The likes of USA, Australia are not sending any diplomats to the games in diplomatic boycott about the human rights situation in China. So I guess that's the broader backdrop. And then we see athletes under immense pressure not to speak up. The IOC has long sought to limit the political expression of athletes within the games environment, and that's only been heightened ahead of these Winter Olympics. There have been veiled threats from games officials about the risks that athletes would face. And I think there's a really open question about whether if an athlete were to speak up about the human rights situation in Xinjiang province, for example, whether they'd be safe, whether they would be safe from arbitrary detention. So that really looms large over these events. The games have been compared to the 1980 Olympics, which obviously were overshadowed by the Cold War, and really back to 1936, the summer games that were held in Nazi Germany.
Finally, Kieran, what about the sporting events we should look out for? I understand that you're a particular fan of curling. I'm not sure I even know what that is.
Curling's a sport that originated on the frozen lakes of Scotland in the 16th century. It's effectively lawn bowls on ice. Australia, my native Australia, is making its debut in the curling. Tayleigh Gill and Dean Hewitt there representing the country, although so far not having the best of start there. Four losses in the opening round robin. Other athletes and sports to watch out for: the Jamaican bobsled team is back for the first time in 24 years. Great Britain, Charlotte Banks, the snowboard cross favourite. She previously represented France at two Olympics and then made the switch to Great Britain, so she'll be one to watch. Michaela Schifrin for the USA. She became the youngest ever gold medalist in the skiing when she was 18 in 2014. And she's entering every individual skiing event. There's five of them. So she'll be really hoping to add to her gold medal tally. Elsewhere, Norway were a slightly surprised victor of the overall medal tally in 2018, a country of just 5.4 million people, and yet they topped the medal tally ahead of powerhouses like the USA, China, Canada, Germany. They'll once again be favourites to finish the tournament on top. The Czech Republic, Estela Deccan, she in 2018 became the first athlete to win gold medals in both the downhill skiing and snowboarding. She'll be attempting to defend those titles. That's quite a remarkable feat when you think about it, given the differences between those two disciplines. And lastly, for the home fans, Eileen Gouge, she was an American-born freestyle skier, but she's switched to China, of which she has ancestry, and is really the face of the games in China. Comparisons have been drawn to Tony Hawk, the skater, in terms of her ability. So she'll really could become a future star, and this could be her breakout Olympics.
Many thanks to Kieran Pender there, speaking to us from the south coast of New South Wales in Australia. And that's all we have time for on today's show. Thanks to our producers, Emma Searle and Charlie Filmer-Court, our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Annabelle Martin, and our studio manager, Nora Hull, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. I'll be with you all morning on the Continental Shift with lots of great programming. And of course, the briefing is at noon. London time. And The Globalist will return at the same time on Monday. That's 7 a.m. in London, 8 a.m. in Zurich and 1500 in Beijing. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.